The Mad Tech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to the Mad Tech Podcast from ExchangeWire, bringing you the latest news from the worlds of media, marketing and e-commerce. I'm John Still, Head of Content at ExchangeWire, and this week I'm thrilled to be joined by our special guest, CEO and founder of consultancy Mamooka APS, Alexander Lund. Alex, thanks so much for joining us. How are you today? How is Copenhagen?
Hey, John. Thank you very much for the invitation. Copenhagen is, well, we have all the Christmas lights up, but it's damn cold, as I guess most places in the Northern Hemisphere. But no, it's cozy. We got the Christmas lights up and everything, so having a grand old time up here.
Lovely. I am also delighted to be joined by ExchangeWire COO and Christmas quiz champion, Lindsay Rountree. Lindsay, how are you this morning?
I'm very well, yes. Christmas quiz champion, although Ciaran has stolen the trophy, which is about right, really, actually. But no, I'm very well. Equally cold here in East London as it is in Copenhagen. I feel like you're more used to it in Copenhagen than we are in London. I'm useless. Completely useless, can't function, can't concentrate, can't feel my fingers or my toes. Yeah, it's having a great time.
Excellent. That Christmas spirit lives in all of us.
Oh, of course. Absolutely.
Cool. Let's set down to this week's news. And our first story of the week is that Tesco are refreshing their media platform to bring precision at scale. Tesco have expanded their media and insights platform by signing partnerships with a number of offsite media owners. The platform, which was launched last year in partnership with dunnhumby, uses Clubcard and in-store data to help brands build stronger relationships with their customers. The new deals, which include partnerships with ITVX, Pinterest, and The Trade Desk, aim to enable brands to reach consumers through new channels and would be supported by cleanroom data provided by InfoSum and LiveRamp. Tesco have also announced plans to provide more on-site advertising opportunities for brands, both in-store and on their website and app, including more sponsored ad placements, as well as a revitalized special offers page. The retailer continues to roll out their smart screen network and in-store connected displays. So they're making a big play in the retail media space. Alex, do you think this is innovative? Is this going to make Tesco a retail media leader?
I think it certainly has the possibilities to get there. There's no doubt that retail media is going to be the next big thing in ad tech. And I think it was like different reports predicted that it would have the same effect as the time we saw video and programmatic, and we saw like the whole banner influx and everything. So it's going to have a massive dent in the industry. On top of that, it comes with the perfect timing, right? You have third-party cookies diminishing, and the need and the call for first-party data. Well, you can say the retail media, they have all this. Tesco has a brilliant example. They have not only the data and the knowledge of being a retailer, but they also have the capabilities to set up clean rooms. So with all their membership data, they can easily connect to all these different brands that can get connected to their user base and really scale up on this clean room idea, which have the general problem of scalability. In my opinion. On top of that, retail media have these many different devices and access points for users. They have some connected displays in-store, or the other in-store options, the TV and the phone of the users. Combine that with a proper CDP setup, then they can really get the users activated towards these brands. So I think the main challenge they're then facing is, okay, how are they going to set up the ad server? But already here, Tesco have considered having special ad placements, having special products for the brands, sponsored brand zones, special offers for the different brands. So it's really an all-around solution they're looking on here. And what it seems so is that they're going to do the whole thing in-house, for better or for worse, right? Because anyone with some knowledge in the industry knows that's certainly a challenge. So it will be interesting to see if they are, how well they're going to connect all these different points, because setting up the ad server on their own digital media is probably going to be the easiest part compared to all the things I mentioned, getting the cross omnichannel working, getting the cross data working and all these things. That's going to be the real challenge. And then of course, getting the brands, included and activated, and to some extent, not compete with them directly. That's going to be the real challenge. So you can say certainly a big, certainly many challenges, but many exciting challenges. If they get the right people on board, they can conquer this field. They could, to answer your question, be the next big tech. But let's see if regulators allow this, right? There's a history that the ones in control of the platforms are also offer a lot of scrutiny in terms of how they can do their business.
Yeah. Ash Whitney, the director of loyalty at Tesco, has said that Tesco's weekly media reach rivals some of the biggest online platforms. Lindsay, are we seeing the start of a potential retail media giant here?
Yeah, I saw that stat. They reckon they have 58% reach across the UK. Was it 58%? Which is significant. I guess I'm not that surprised by that because Tesco is a behemoth when it comes to being a retailer and a grocer both online and in store. I do think that they, from a retail media perspective, they have so much opportunity and probably more opportunity than any other supermarket in the UK to really capitalise on that because of the Tesco Clubcard data, which has long been the most used and most valuable of all the different supermarket club cards and loyalty cards that exist. And obviously the work, you know, with Dunnhumby and everything they can do with the data they have there, I think it's an interesting opportunity. I think Alex's point about regulation is an interesting one because you do start to wonder if all these kind of fairly large, sizable walled gardens that are being created through retail, the explosion of retail media, will start to come under fire in some way. And I wonder what that could look like. I think the problem we have with digital often, with anything kind of digital, be it commerce, be it kind of programmatic advertising, whatever, is that these things grow more quickly than the regulators have a chance to really understand what's happening. By the time they do understand what's happening, they've grown to such size that then they don't know how to regulate them. So I do wonder about that from the retail media perspective and actually what that could look like. You know, you're seeing it in the US, the likes of Walmart and Kroger and everything else. Like Tesco has a big opportunity to do the same thing over here. We're seeing it a lot in Southeast Asia as well, with a lot of the big retailers over there. And the big platforms over there, not just retailers, but platforms like Grab, etc., that are able to tap in with their first-party data and activate kind of brand engagement through that. I think there's huge opportunity. And I think that Tesco is the most logical company to really win at this in the UK market anyway. Alex mentioned, you know, cannibalization, competition with Tesco and other brands. I think what interests me about retail media is the opportunity beyond retail, if you like. It's the opportunity for like non-endemic brands. So like an insurer to be able to use retail data to effectively target people and you know, how could an insurer, for example, understand more about their customers based on what they're buying from a supermarket or what they're buying from, I mean, Tesco isn't just a supermarket, it sells anything and everything nowadays, but how can they make the use of that? But of course, Tesco also sells insurance. So where's the competition lie and kind of where do you separate the products you sell as a retailer and you as a data platform? I think will be very, very interesting to see what it looks like going forward.
Yeah. If I can add something to that, I think it's, as I said, that there's going to be a lot of gray areas they start to move into, right? And on top of that, I think these retailers always had a business of changing money for promoting different products. But that's going to become much more in the open now with this whole retail media network. And where that is going is an open field of, yeah, regulatory scrutiny, but also as a competitive advantages that might be more open than what they really desire.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very, you both brought really interesting points there in terms of kind of both the size and scale that Tesco have and also the potential regulatory aspect of it. But retail media, we are continually hearing, is going to be the big area of 2023. Alex, do you see more brands moving into this? Do you see this as a huge area for next year?
Yeah, I see that's a huge area. And I think all the big retail media chains in the world are going to massively invest in this. Now we're just focusing on the very big ones in the biggest countries, but you're also going to see everyone moving into it on both medium and large scale enterprises. We see the tendency up in Denmark or in the Nordics a lot, and they need to crack the code on where exactly is the business here. One thing is to get your ad server up and get all your special ad products set up for the different brands. That's the first step, right? And maybe there's some cross marketing to other platforms in that sense. So it's going to have a certain marketing value, but also sort of an ad sales brand value. But then comes the whole first party data necessity, how to set up clean rooms, how to get these connected onto your platforms and to different brands. That's a whole other element in terms of capitalizing on your first party data on the users. Then come these omni-channel element that I think the time is over of issuing discount papers with all the different things you can buy this week. And it's about time to digitalize that, both for the pure sense of where the world is going, but also for an ecological point of view. So that's another element. So that's a lot of different business areas in this. And I think where the retail media really needs to be clear is how to structure and how to strategize this whole move, because there's plenty of things to be done, but one thing needs to lead to another, and you really need to focus on the stuff that can be capitalized in the best way, but also maybe in the easiest way before you go to the next step. So there's a lot of different steps in this whole thing, and that's going to be very interesting next year to see what different routes the different retail partners are going to take.
Yeah, it's definitely one that we'll be covering a lot over the next 12 months and seeing where it goes. Tesco could be a really interesting case in point for that. And there were a couple of points in there that link nicely to our second story of the week. You know, we've talked about walled gardens and regulation, and we will now discuss Amazon's agreement to the EU changes around their product promotion. Amazon has reportedly agreed to change how they promote their own brand products on their online marketplace. The move could resolve a long-running antitrust dispute between the European Union. Launched in 2009, the investigation sought to determine whether the e-commerce giant used granular retailer data to give their own offerings a boost in contravention of EU law. According to the Financial Times, Amazon has agreed to promote competitor brands in the buy box found at the top of the marketplace's page, making them more prominent to customers. The agreement is expected to be officially announced on the 20th of December and to last for 5 years, therefore meaning it must conform to the upcoming DMA, Digital Markets Act. Lindsay, we've talked a lot about the Digital Markets Act. How do you feel it can curtail the power of big tech and Amazon in particular here?
I don't know. I think that the thing about Amazon is we've been on a long and slow journey to get to this point. Like, it started out with Amazon first being accused maybe 5 years ago of copying like high-performing brands. So brands with high-performing products on Amazon. Amazon were going away and manufacturing themselves, then selling them under their own brand names or brand names that we didn't realise. So that was the first thing that came out. That was then curtailed. Then we discovered that there were about 75 brands that we believed were independent brands that it turned out were owned by Amazon. No one had a clue they were buying Amazon-owned brands. So another way that Amazon misled us and pulled the wool over our eyes. Well done, Amazon. It worked. So they then had to label the fact that these brands were an Amazon brand. So you've got like Eono or Happy Belly, or I can't remember any of the other ones. There's so many of them across every single different category, an Amazon brand. So now you know what you're buying. And now we have this problem that Amazon are still promoting only their own brands, which are being labeled as an Amazon brand in the buy box, and not promoting, not sharing kind of other people's stuff. The thing about the DMA going after Amazon on this is that what Amazon are doing is obvious. Like, it became very obvious in the very beginning. Like, it's the problem with going after big tech more generally, kind of in the digital advertising space, like Google, like Meta, is that what they're doing is more clandestine. It's not as easy to see. And when you confront the likes of Google and Meta with what they're doing, they'll come back to you and say, well, this can't be proven. This is how it works. And they'll basically confuse people. They use smoke and mirrors to confuse regulators. They aren't really sure what's going on, and it'll take 5-10 years for anything to kind of get down the line. With Amazon, from the very beginning, it was very obvious that they were doing it, because literally you could see it, any consumer could see it on Amazon's marketplace. And that is where I think, I mean, the fact that this is happening for Amazon is great, because Amazon it's long been questioned how Amazon are using retailer data, the data from their own sellers' marketplace to be able to improve their own product and improve their own algorithm and improve their own platform. I think that in terms of big tech more generally, it remains to be seen how effective what the DMA is aiming to do, how effective that will actually be. But I'm ever the cynic when it comes to anything big tech related.
Yeah. Alex, how do you feel about that?
No, I couldn't agree more. You sit back with that feeling, it's like, oh, it's Amazon again. And it's like, well, was this really a surprise? I thought we were all like kind of just aware of it and accepted the fact that this is how the big take earn money, right? They have a foot in every camp and then take that cut wherever it is. And for a long time, it was kind of admired that, wow, they could create this market, but also act into it and then take a little cut here and there. And it was kind of the business model. So I think as a, I don't know how much we should hope for this, because it seems like the EU Commission or whatever regulation comes is always a few years behind, right? So the Amazons and the big tech, they have already written this off. And I wonder just that for the next big idea, they would just add 10% to the projected revenue uplift before they put it live and then just do it anyway. The thing is that there's so many things going on in these big tech companies, and they need to get involved with different things in order to make the business working, or at least increase the profit to some extent. And yeah, you can accept it or not. I think it's part of acting on these platforms. When that has been said, it's good that the EU Commission is actually trying to do something, trying to prevent it, if not tomorrow, then in 5 or 10 years, and try to find a solution for it. I know that the EU Commission was quoted on, they tried to create a big Chinese wall between certain aspects of the Amazon business. If that's going to work, or I'm not sure, but at least this is being highlighted, and at least they can say this whole self-preferencing business model that Amazon is doing, it's not ethical, and it's in the end not legal either. But it's, I recall not 5 years ago, but 2 years ago or something, that Amazon was also enabling competitors' audiences if you wanted to put your own campaign on, right? So if you had you want to promote some audio cars, you could use the audience for BMW. Or so there's a lot of things to unravel in terms of how that business model works. But you have these big guys who just say, yeah, but it was possible, so why would you not do it? And then later on try to correct it when someone comes to tell them it's not legal.
Yeah, exactly. It was possible, so let's do it. And the point of the DMA is to stop these large platforms acting as gatekeepers. There's been a lot of chatter this week about Google's Performance Max product, which is called PMax, and which is the ultimate black box. You give Google some money, Google will then put that, and you give them your money and your access to your CRM and your first party data. They will then put that money into, it could be YouTube, Gmail, search, in any platform that Google owns, as well as its own kind of, as well as the third party inventory. And you have no idea where it goes. You have no idea what's being done with it. It's all done on ROAS target. So apparently people are putting money into it because it works. But Google is the ultimate gatekeeper for that kind of methodology, that kind of campaign. So that's the ultimate thing that the DMA should be trying to stop, is me giving you something and you not giving me as the advertiser with the money any control over what happens to my money. All I know is that it works, but there's obviously talk about cannibalization of brand terms on search, or cannibalization, or actually are Google actually just retargeting users I would have got anyway to make it look like this is working, actually it isn't. There's a lot of chatter around it this week, but I find it, Alex Change did a great article on it yesterday, but I find it fascinating that is one of the kind of the big things that's coming out of, you know, in a cookieless environment that we haven't now operate in. These are the kind of products we'll see. These are the kind of products the DMA will probably be actively trying to stop, but advertisers will use them because they work, and I'm using air quotes here, and Google will create them because they say, well, we haven't got to provide this information to you. Well, maybe you do, because that's the whole point of this, is you're trying to be open and transparent. This is completely the opposite of that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think what you're hitting there is also the Google the Facebook and stuff, they constantly try to persuade you into using different technologies on their platforms for you to make a marginal increase in your earnings or your profit, right? But without telling you that when you do this, they get better insights into your data and they increase their earnings tenfold based on the information they can take out of you. The same with the Amazon setup here, right? So they give you a little bit for the advertisers, try to like persuade you into their business model. And ultimately, the problem is that you as an publisher or advertiser or whoever is using that platform is, you're not aware of this transaction. Being now we're all about cookies, we're all about consent on the internet, which is literally just the tip of the iceberg, because it is ingrained in all these platforms and how technology works today, that there is a very big trade-off that the users of those platforms are not fully aware of, blissfully ignorant towards what the cost might be.
Yeah, we love to bury our heads in the sand and act like everything's okay. And as long as it works, it's fine. I haven't got to know how the sausage is made. I will just carry on regardless. And that's true of many things. I haven't got to know how the aeroplane is built to be able to feel comfortable using an aeroplane. But I feel like this is a different scenario that needs to be addressed in a different way.
Sorry, Alex, were you about to go in?
Yeah, I was just about to raise the open question about how should it be defined. But I think that's a very long discussion, right? There's a lot to unravel in terms of how open should you be. But it's absolutely true that dealing with Google is not a very open partnership. And it does develop into just knowing there's a big black box, and your surprise is not whenever they open up for the black box. It's just like you keep getting surprised how big that black box actually is and how much is going on behind the curtain. But I think as publishers, advertisers, everyone in the market grows more aware of the technology and understand the dynamics better, we start to raise the good questions. We start to ask the right things in order to unravel these mysteries and ultimately take better control of the whole setup, do more things in-house, try to break the chains to these guys, and be aware that when we engage with them, it might handcuff us in some way. So we need to have a key at hand, or we need to just ultimately say no before we get too fine.
Yeah. To end this section with a small ray of hope, it seems that the EU Commission have had a bit of success this week in terms of Apple potentially opening up their app store to third-party developers after being frequently fined monthly last year in Holland. Lindsay,
yeah,
does
that's
that give
huge.
You... Yeah, does that give you a little bit of hope that labyrinthine as the regulatory process is, do you think it can really make a difference in opening up these platforms?
I think we are seeing changes. We are seeing improvements. The Apple news is absolutely massive because finally they are accepting. But it's not, it's a mixture of, you know, regulators have had to kind of push the envelope here quite a bit in terms of trying to get them to do this, but also so have some of Apple's big spenders. Some of Apple's big spenders have been really forceful about this. And even, you know, Twitter announcing with the they're bringing Twitter Blue back. If you buy Twitter Blue via any other platform, via web platform, it'll cost you $8. If you buy it via the App Store, it'll cost you $11 because of the 30% fee that Apple's charging. I was thinking the other day, I'm surprised we aren't seeing more companies doing that, saying buy it via us directly for this price, or buy it via Apple for a higher price because of what Apple charges. Well, actually, the timing's perfect, really, because Apple are now going to open up everything to third-party platforms, which is a really, really big change, given Apple's one of the biggest walled gardens in the world. I'm interested to see what that will look like in the coming years.
Yeah, Alex, do you think this is a positive step?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's how the free market should work, right? Even though that you own certain platforms, there should be allowed for everything. But if this is certainly a step in the right direction, but if it's a sign of the tendency, I'm not entirely sure. I think what we see right now is even more walled gardens, like big networks trying to create their own environment of data, taking a lot of inspiration of how these guys have done it within the news media industry. There's a lot of attempts to create your own your own environment, your own walled garden here to a certain degree.
Yeah, it will be definitely one to keep an eye out in terms of how that shakes out and how that works in terms of Apple and how they open things up. Moving on to our third story of the week, and news that was probably been expected to be coming for quite a while given economic circumstances, but the news that 2023 advertising growth forecasts have been revised downwards. Prominent advertising firms have adjusted their predictions for global advertising growth in 2023, suggesting that it may be slower than previously forecast. Media investment firm Magna now predicts that media owners' ad revenue will increase by 4.8% to $833 billion next year, a drop from the 6.3% predicted in June. Meanwhile, media and data behemoth Group M has forecast that global advertising revenue will rise 5.9% next year, a drop from its earlier estimation of 6.4%. Group M also noted that it anticipates growth in China to be stymied due to the country's pandemic-related lockdowns, with a report from the company reading, "One could make the argument that we are in a global post-COVID-19 war period marked by the aftereffects of government fiscal policy and major supply chain disruptions." The company went on to state, "That's why we're not seeing the universal downturn, not yet anyway, of 2008 or even 2001, despite most companies reminding us that they are proceeding with an abundance of caution." So, Alex, how do you think advertisers can prepare for these lower forecasted ad spends, and where is the money going to go basically in the next year?
That's a really good question. I mean, it's been written on the wall that 2023 is going to be a challenging year, no doubt about it. But that, when that has been said, it's been tumultuous few years recently, and things are coming out on top. So I'm actually leaning towards the more optimistic side here. Very often we say things will be super bad, but it seems now we're talking about the big tech here, and they have taken adjustments towards preparing for these bad times. A lot of companies have made significant reduction in staff, and I think a lot of companies are prepared for this. When that has been said, I think we're also looking at a lot of new tech being introduced that's going to even more increase the how we rely on marketing technology and digital ads. I think when companies are going to be challenged on their revenue streams in this day and age, they actually tend to go more into their marketing budgets rather than reducing them as they were doing the old times, because there's like the general notion, if it's bad economic times, you reduce your marketing budget. So I think here there's more, that there has become a stronger relation between marketing budgets and your earnings. So you just need to find the right marketing channels. Therefore, I tend to think that the growth is not going to be reduced so much, but money are going to be spent differently. I think people are going to look more inwards in terms of how can they identify the right channels, how can they create a better balance between investment and return on these channels, not just spreading money around in all the different exchanges without really being aware of does it have any benefits. I think there's going to be a lot of inward reflection towards where the money goes, but not necessarily cutting in the budgets, just put them differently. And then I think some industries will benefit from a changing time. I heard just a couple of months ago that the used car industry, for instance, hadn't spent any money on marketing because that was not really necessary during the COVID. Now that has turned around, so they start to spend a lot of time in the marketing. And I think this article also mentioned entertainment as being an industry that is looking into spending a lot of marketing dollars as these changing times will come. So I think some industries are going to increase while others will reduce. So it's hard to say how it's going to influence in a really negative way. I think we're definitely still looking at growth, and maybe even more than has been predicted here.
Interesting. Lindsay, how do you see it shaking out in terms of, you know, these, as Alex said, the predictions have been lowered, but this is by no means, you know, it's not loss, it's still growth. It's just a bit less of a percentage than it was. How do you think that this will shake out next year?
Yeah, I think like Alex, I am cautiously optimistic, despite sitting in the UK, which at the moment is an economic hellhole. I feel like, I mean, the forecast could have been dropped far more than they have been. It's actually quite minimal in terms of how they've reforecasted them downwards. And I agree with Alex. There is, it's not a recession as we know it, because there are certain industries that are still going to be buoyant. Like Alex, you mentioned entertainment and the used car industry. I mean, the used car industry is insane in the UK. I'm assuming this is a global phenomenon as well. Like the cost of a used car is more than a new car at the moment, which is just bonkers. But also travel, there's still huge demand for travel. And, you know, many airlines are able to, you know, they're still not running at a full capacity, but they're able to really kind of rake the money at the moment. I don't know if anyone's flown anywhere recently, but the cost of flights is insane at the moment. And I do think that there is, everyone I'm speaking to seems to be cautious, but they don't seem to be riddled with fear when it comes to budgets next year, when it comes to, you know, if you work for a tech company, if you work for a publisher, if you work for an agency, or if you work for a brand, nobody seems to be really worried. And they're kind of like, you know, there are things happening. We have to be realistic. There are layoffs happening. There are budgets being cut. Things will look different next year. But I think that people assuming things are going to spiral, I don't think that's going to happen, but we have to be realistic about what's going to happen. And some of the things Alex just said there, I totally agree with. We'll see a lot more supply path optimization. People will be a lot more strict about where their money goes, how their money is working for them. I don't necessarily think that many big brands will reduce their budgets necessarily. They will distribute them differently across different channels, across different ways of gaining revenue or what works for them. And that, I think, represents an interesting time. Also, like Rachel, this is a fourth person story, so this is literally not from the horse's mouth remotely. But Rachel's currently in Singapore before she flies back to the mothership for Christmas. She's not an alien. Motherland, whatever, mothership's probably more appropriate. Sorry, Rachel. Rachel Smith, I'm talking about, our CEO. You will know her if you listen to the podcast. But anyway, this is going on a tangent. She's currently in Singapore before she flies out to Australia, but she was having a chat with somebody yesterday who their company had a forecaster, an analyst, industry analyst come in and explain to them kind of what's happening, what they're seeing from their perspective globally in terms of recession. And apparently the UK is the worst country in the world. And the kind of the one with the lowest forecast, and the one that really needs to kind of like look at what's going on. Europe isn't great, so lucky for you, Alex, you're not in the great camp either. They're sitting over there in Denmark, but the UK is completely screwed. However, there are still opportunities, and the analysts don't believe that it's going to be a slow downturn. They believe the uptick will happen fairly quickly, which is positive for even us in the UK where things are so bad. But where we talked about this at ATS Singapore back in October, but where opportunity still seems to be really, really buoyant is Southeast Asia. Asia will not experience a recession like Europe and North America will. And obviously the comment about China because of COVID restrictions, that's interesting because I think they are going to see challenges if they consist on going after zero COVID still, and the problems they've had there are going to cause challenges. But a lot of the companies that exist out in the Asia region are going after the growth market of Southeast Asia. They will not see a recession. So there's huge opportunity there. If you're looking for growth next year, that's where to go.
Yeah, so just not the UK.
Yeah, don't bother coming here. Nothing here for you.
Fair enough. Alex, you were kind enough to give us your prediction for our economy and ad spend predictions piece yesterday. And, you know, in terms of saying that marketers are going to have to be a bit more careful in what they look for, you've predicted that awareness is going to be a very important metric in the coming year. Do you think that's something that marketers really need to be careful on?
I mean, it's always buzzwords flying around, right, John? This time it's awareness CPM, that's the new big one where you tie a second in view to your BCPM or your viewability CPM. So you make a complex KPI even more complex, and we like to do that, right? More abbreviations, more complexity to how to measure things. But I think it ties up to what I said before, that instead of just mindlessly connect with a lot of different channels and sources and technologies, you really need to be cautious about your stack and your supply chain. And this is tied up to that. You need to be very clear about what exactly do you want to get out of this and what is the long-term goal in building up your ad stack. So what I'm doing a lot in Mamooga is helping publishers, but also different technical vendors to tie into a long-term strategy. So for an advertiser, connecting or buying advertising space across the market, they need to figure out what is the end goal here. If they want to figure out for how many seconds a user is looking at their ad, it's not enough to buy through the open exchange that doesn't allow for this reporting. They actually need to engage with the publisher where they can strengthen the partnership around reporting, around automation for optimization within these different KPIs, and in that sense, increase their competitive advantage or their marketing efforts towards the end goal. So it ties up to inward reflection and evaluation about how are you building your ad stack. And I think the next year is going to be very much dominated by this. Sure, there's buzzwords around clean rooms and retail media about awareness, CPM, or what it might be. But the matter of the fact is that the business strategy is going to be around strengthening partnerships on the basis of internal processes, internal systems, and how these things speak together. So you make create common goals, not just adhere to the masses. And I think that's a very important point for the next year. And I think that's going to be pushed forward by this whole recession thinking.
Yeah, that leads us really nicely on actually to the next section of the pod, where we will discuss a bit about what you're doing, Alex, what you're doing with Mamooka, and how it's been going for you and what's coming up for you. You wrote a very punchily titled piece for ExchangeWire this year, entitled A Future Without Programmatic Open Auctions. Can you tell us a little bit about the thinking behind that and what you're doing with Mamooka?
Yeah, I had a bit of interesting feedback from the big guys on that piece.
Good.
I thought it was fun to mention. At the end of the day, it was not really like end of open exchange, right? It was more a matter of open exchange need to be revised. It shouldn't be like the front and center of your ad stack and your ad revenues as a publisher. But taking one step back, what I do with Mamooka is I'm consulting publishers on how to build their ad stack, how to design it for long-term growth, and create a whole project plan in terms of how you develop your ad revenues. On top of that, it is connecting with different partners, different tech vendors, and get everything aligned into a coherent strategy. And it has changed a little bit to also be dealing with different tech vendors and different data marketplaces to better understand the whole data market and data transactions and what should be done and what can be done to respond to the need for first-party data, but also respond to the lack of third-party cookies and third-party data. So a lot of different areas, bit of a all-round guide for different things and helping them build good relationships in the whole ad revenue sphere.
Nice. And you know, you've mentioned in the piece that you said you got some interesting feedback. I'm keen to hear what people have thought about your ideas on this.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, my friends over at Google didn't think it was like completely correct to say that this is where their edX should be in the future. But
well, they would say that.
They would say that, and they kind of understood the arguments and found it interesting to see how the market changed, right? And I think, as far as I can read this, they also try to act on it. They try to figure out how can they create Google IDs, publisher IDs, how can they get the first party data into their whole flat privacy sandbox projects there. So they are aware of this change. And I think what we're looking at as publisher on the sell side, but also on the buy side, is the opportunity to take back some control and create this transparency. And capitalize on all the knowledge we have gained over the years. In this sense, I think we have just, I wouldn't say blindly, but very, very hungry. We have connected to a lot of different open exchanges. We have really tried to build the base of programmatic income. And now comes the time for the traditional ways, as we're giving those a renaissance, the IO campaigns, the direct deals to different partners. And we need to think about how we're going to do this. Are we going to take our first party data and make it exclusive to these guys? Are we going to develop a bridge in our direct reporting and optimization? So this will be possible. Are we going to create new creative products, like you saw with Tesco. They might make these brand zones and different exclusive ad placements where you can only have certain deals, certain brands. And the final point is to push the open auction a little bit, right? So create an internal competition in a better way. And I think that's going to be very interesting because it gives us the opportunity to create a proper sales funnel for our clients, for our advertisers as a publisher. It creates the opportunity for advertisers to get a better overview of all the different channels and all the different supply chains. So I think with that strengthened partnership, we can help each other create a more transparent supply chain and benefit from the technology that's going to be born out of it.
In discussions that you and I have had over the past few months, you've talked a lot about the big opportunity in this, the demise of the third party cookie, and particularly that is an opportunity to clean up the ad stack, to really kind of take a look at the transparency and really dive into the operations. Are you still feeling positive about that and the opportunities that lie in there in terms of identifying hidden gems and seeing what can really add value to an ad stack?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's I think for the open auction, that's where we began, and that was a very interesting era of the whole monetization setup. But now comes, in order to build that up, you need to use the open auction just as a lead generator, in lack of a better word, and you need to identify the advertisers you can bring up on a more exclusive level, on a stronger partnership level, and get them activated on multiple different sales channels, being guaranteed, programmatic, non-programmatic, floor, fixed prices, different targeting on both your audience data, your contextual data, your placement data, your creative stuff, and really sit down and figure out how do you organize this whole thing. I mean, how can you develop your client relationship from an open auction to a private auction to a preferred deal to programmatic guarantee to IO, and have them activated on all these different levels by understanding the client a lot better? So now we have all the connections, right? But in order to develop those connections, you really need to have a clear idea about what each connection give of value to your client and how you're going to activate the client across all these different channels. And that is going to be powered by, for example, first-party data. But first-party data is just going to be an element in this context. And another thing we're looking at right now is how first-party data could be enabled through pre-bid and then create more connections in the pre-bid header bidding sphere. Meaning, instead of just having big exchanges in the header bidding, well, you could start to actually create direct partnerships with agencies, for instance, maybe even very big advertisers. And in this way, create some sort of exclusivity on your first-party data or certain placements and new type of deals that has a little bit of the programmatic deal and a little bit of the open exchange combined into a header bidding solution, which is only fostered because both parties at the table are starting to understand the technology that Google understood, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago, or whatever that was.
It feels like as well, I mean, I guess we kind of touched upon this in the last story, but all these ideas you're talking about as ways of streamlining and kind of making programmatic work harder, be it through still going going like having a combination of the open auction and direct relationships with publishers and direct deals. All it actually serves the kind of added purpose of actually making you look at your programmatic supply chain, streamlining where you can. If we're moving to a recession, that could actually help you save money and work out how to gain efficiencies in other ways. But also, of course, globally, everyone's talking about ESG at the moment, sustainability. It could also actually help with that down the line as well, because you're actually probably, again, reducing the number of auctions against your inventory. You're actually kind of making your supply chain more sustainable in the process. So actually, it could have added benefits down the line as well.
Absolutely, it's beautiful how everything comes together, right?
Isn't
when,
it?
when everything is put out there, I think it actually is. I think these ideas kind of leads up to a higher goal, and I think with the focus on having transparency and control, not necessarily sidelined, but definitely together with revenue gains and revenue uplift, I think you start to have the right tools to build out a strategy. Because this transparency and this control that ultimately leads to long-term revenue. So I think that's a very interesting point of view having on your business growth, that it's not just short-term gains all the time. It's also a matter of the bigger perspective. Being ESG or whatever it might be, it's just a way to develop your business in a sustainable way. I think what will also come out of this is healthy ways that you enable your data, keep control of it and share it with the right people. Don't haste into making certain solutions, but really take your time to evaluate how is this going to look in 2 years from now, in 3 years, 5 years from now, because it's more in our hand to drive our hand. Now I'm just talking for all the publishers in the world and all the buyers and stuff, right? Like, there's a lot of us. but it's more in the hands of the individual, let's put it like that. It's in the hand of the individual to actually make the change and take control of that change and see whether it fits in. And then you can add with all these other elements. I'm working with a partner that's very engaged in probabilistic data and how you can extract information about income, cars, kids, and so on an IP address, which is ultimately not first, it's not third party, because they would just tie this IP address up to a certain area, and then that whole area is reflected in some offline data catalogs and thereby providing the data. That's a new way of also thinking about how you create your own ecosystem of assets, and that in turn is built up about, okay, but you sell all these things to the different advertisers and you create your own value. You don't need the middleman to create cohorts for you. You don't need it to connect you with the different platforms and exchanges and so on. You can do a lot of it yourself. So ultimately focusing on this net media and challenging the status quo and all the different links in between, that is going to create a more stable business model, in my opinion. And then the easy thing is, of course, once you go on this journey, you can turn up and down, right? So should you find yourself in a recession and everything is going to shit, yeah, then you can turn up for the open auction again and take out the parachute.
What a great description.
Yeah, well, we've all that to look forward to in 2023. And Alex, we're really looking forward to keeping up with you on what you're doing and how it's all going. I'm looking forward to working with you more next year. That is all we have time for today. But Alex, thank you so much for joining us, and have a lovely festive season.
Thank you so much, guys. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Great chat.
Great chat. That's all for today. Keep an eye on exchangewire.com for our 2023 prediction series. We've got a lot of verticals and a lot to discover. And join us next week, where we will be having a special podcast as we delve through a lot of those predictions and give some of our own. Thank you for joining us this week.